At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
It's the Wonky Show. DfE's funding letter is out. We'll size up the cuts. Disabled students' allowance is on the table. We'll work out why. And there's a big headache for nursing students. It's all coming up.
Whereas I think if the resource sits with the individual student and you're thinking about going to university, actually, pragmatically, part of your choice may well rest on the kind of support that you're able to secure to support your learning at a particular place.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly round to this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's Associate Editor Jim Dickinson, and here to fully immerse in this week's vat of misery, as usual, three brilliant guests. In York, Pete Quinn is an HE inclusion consultant. Pete, your highlight of the week, please.
So I did an event during University Celebration Week, which wasn't too far ago, and one of the participants has got back in touch this week out of the blue to say, as a result of joining the session and hearing what people were saying, she's talked to her employer about their neurodiverse situation and has had such a good response. It was just really nice to hear some good news this week, as you say, in the vat of misery.
Cracking stuff. In Gravesend, Selena Bolingbroke is principal at the Building Crafts College. Selena, your highlight.
Hi, Jim. It's been a bit of a quiet couple of weeks because we've been on Easter holidays at the Building Crafts College. I did get to go to a very good Grayson Perry lecture last week, which was at the Worshipful Company of Carpenters. Very good reflections on creativity and craft. But I think my personal highlight this week actually came this morning, where I think that I have outwitted a squirrel in my back garden that has been frustrating me for weeks with one application of WD-40.
Well, there we go. And in Colwyn Bay this week, James Coe is Associate Editor at Wonky. James, your highlight of the week, please.
Hiya, Jim, and congratulations, Selena. My highlight of the week has to be the new rules event that we hosted with student unions, Jim, where we got a load of student unions together to reimagine what the future of our movement can look like. And I left feeling excited, inspired, and a little bit intimidated at how good some of our young leaders are.
Yes, it was great stuff. So, yes, we start this week with funding. The Department for Education fired out its annual funding letter last week, James, and it's all very familiar.
Jim, I've got a question for you. When is a strategic grant letter not a strategic grant letter?
When it's not very strategic? I don't know.
When it includes absolutely everything. So, Jim, the Department for Education sent the Office for Students their strategic grant letter, which in theory sets out what they want the Office for Students to spend funding on to support strategic things. The problem is, it includes absolutely everything. It includes funding for high-cost programmes, degree apprenticeships, Level 4 and 5, NHS long-term work plan, specialist programmes, student premiums, mental health, capital funding, and onwards and onwards. It is including a lot of things. So you can see on the site there are lots of specific funding changes, but I just want to talk about what does this mean for the shape of the sector before we get into it. And I think there's three big things. One, there is this ongoing imbalance between funding for arts and funding for STEMs. Maintaining real terms funding for creative subjects is, of course, a significant real terms cut. The second, I think, is about the shape of access and student support. There is yet another significant cut for UniConnect, which is the access program across the sector, that is now down to around 20 million from 60 million in 2021. And the third thing by means of opening is what isn't in there. And I think if you were to ask anybody with a familiarity of higher education finance, what is your strategic challenge? It is not enough cash against inflation with increasing demands. So not lots of good news, not lots of new money, and some big questions left unanswered.
Selena, well, obviously, you know, the government doesn't really have many or indeed big levers to pull over higher education anymore. To what extent will this move the dial?
The misery dial. I think we've kind of reached 11 some time ago. But you're right, in terms of from where we were to where this takes us, actually, I don't think that, you know, it is a significant step because we were already in a very bad place. And there is no, you know, they're literally, although, as James says, it covers a very wide range of areas, there is literally no good news in there at all. But if you are in a university or indeed even in the EFE sector, although this letter's not about that, and you've got creative courses to resource, I think one of the biggest frustrations is there is plenty of student demand there. There is plenty of employer demand, but the resources have not fit so that you can properly kind of cut your cloth and deliver quality creative courses for some years now. This is just a further paper cut. But as we know around paper cuts, there will always be one that for certain institutions and certain circumstances become the fatal cut. I think the other thing that I'm concerned about sort of working at more of the craft end of creative education provision is what happens is at the kind of shop floor level, the only way to create a resource base that means that you can continue to run that course is you move more of it into a kind of classroom setting because classroom-based courses are cheaper to run. But that's not what industry need and that's not proper vocational creative education. So the overall quality comes down, and that will take a long time to restore.
Pete, I get the impression that, you know, we basically have a heavily demand-led system. You know, most of the money isn't in this grant-led, so it's in tuition fees. And but actually, the one of the places we've ended up is that politicians appear to not like what people are picking. And therefore, instead of saying, well, okay, we'll restrict places, they're just chopping back the kind of per-person funding. And that just makes it miserable for everyone, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I think, you know, misery is not optional at all. They've just cut, they've chronically underfunded the system for the duration of their tenure. You know, it used to be, I used to think, surely they're not sitting around with a spreadsheet going, oh, that looks a lot, let's get rid of that. That looks a lot, let's get rid of that. But it seems like they have. And there are all these performative commitments to student mental health, to suicide prevention, to all those really challenging areas of the student journey and student life, and they are being, you know, cut away deliberately in this because there's no additional money to take into account inflation. So when you hear a politician, and they write this peppered throughout the letter, we are committed to, we are, you know, delighted to support, we are committed to. It's
one of our priorities.
Yeah, it's all performative. It's absolutely performative, and I don't think they even care anymore. As I think you've pointed out in the blog, you know, the signature's just a JPEG file, and you know, it's almost a copy and paste bit. Did ChatGPT write this letter, perhaps? You know, it's just so we're at this level. So I used to think, you know, that people knew what they were doing at senior levels in some organizations, but I don't think they're even trying very hard anymore. And we can all sit about it and kind of feel a little lighthearted about it in the vat of misery, but it really is going to have absolutely significant consequences to not just student mental health, but to the colleagues that we've got in the sector who, again, are trying their absolute best to give a really good experience with less money and less resources and an acknowledgement that the government really doesn't care. But yet you'll land at any UK airport and there'll be a poster there talking about the world-class institutions, but they're not funding them.
So, Jim, for balance, if you had to make the case to say, actually, what is the strategic intent behind this? I think what the government would argue is two things, is to say, Financial Times are really tough and you have to make choices, not just in education. And one of the choices we make is to maintain funding, which of course of inflation has occurred. But if you look towards other services, then of course, actually, you know, there is some protection there. I think the second argument they would probably make is it is totally legitimate to spend public funding on things that we think is best for the economy. And one of the expressions of doing that is funding STEM at the expense of other things. I think where that argument falls down is on two things. The first is that the economy is this big, unpredictable, ever dynamic thing. And the thing that we know gets rewarded is having a broad base of people with a broad base of skills and simultaneously cutting both the funding for people and the funding for the broad programmes. It is not a sensible labour market intervention. And I think the second is, to go to your point, we have a market-led system and a state-led regulator. And you can't really have both. I think if you'd say, do you want the opposite system of a state-funded primary system and a market-led regulator, then you would end up with something that looks a bit more like this. We seem to have got confused what the purpose is between regulation and funding and the labour market.
Yeah. And actually then, Selina, I mean, I guess in some ways, as well as the kind of lack of thinking, we're in an election year, we know the kind of, you know, the mechanics of the state kind of slow down. More generally, I mean, I was reading, Heppy have got a collection of essays out today on, you know, how to fund the sector. But one of the things I was thinking about when I was reading it was, the thing here is that if the state is really interested in what is delivered, where it's delivered, and who it's being delivered to, but wants the majority of the money to be paid back when students take out a loan for it, those aren't compatible, are they? I mean, if the state's really interested, it needs to find some state money. Whereas if much of this is coming through loans, most of which, thanks to changes, will be paid back, they are boxed in terms of the levers they can pull, the buttons they can push, where they can demand HEs and so on and so on, aren't they?
Yes, I think they are. And I think, we've talked about this before at length. In some ways, I think we've probably exhausted it's not just the frustration of where we are now. Really, this policy goes back to the student being at the heart of the system. That was what this whole sort of last 10 years or so, 12, 13, 13 years it is now, was supposed to deliver on. It was supposed to be market-led, demand-led, and with the freedom and flexibilities for institutions to deliver around that demand. And frankly, I think that the overall kind of vision hasn't been cited by anybody in government for the last 5 years, because the policies that come out are conflicting. And as you say, Jim, you can't have both things. And I think it goes back a little to what James says. You need to understand what you're trying to do from both a regulation and a provision point of view. Is it about state control? Is it about being responsive to the market?
And I don't spend as much time as it sounds in airports, but when you come back from wherever you've travelled to and realise that the UK really isn't doing well at the moment, infrastructure-wise, everything else-wise, you see the imagery on the wall about not just that we're an educational hub, but that we're a creative industries hub. And that's what we really excel at in this country, irrespective of the market barriers that have been put in place by this government. But yeah, they're, if you talk to real people, that's what they want to do. They want to express themselves. They want to do work that gives them meaning and purpose. And they want to work at a community level. And that's where kind of hubs outside of university cities and towns have been developing. But we're just not seeing the reality of this. And I think in terms of this area, it's not just the case that that we need to invest in health above education or in other areas of the government. That education is a key determinant for health equality. That's what the Marmot Review told us a long time ago. And that for young people, adults, everyone to maximise their...
Well, Jim, I think it kind of relates to this point about what's being funded and what's needed and what government ministers understand about the education system. So let's just take one slice of my world, which is largely around construction craft. Every government for the last like 50 years and future governments will make a commitment to building new homes because we need more housing. We need more infrastructure. So we need people who work in construction. One of the things that is proposed at the moment is that the funding that is currently used for technical qualifications to get 16 to 18 year olds to be bricklayers, carpenters, joiners is to be withdrawn from next September, September 25, to basically push everybody into T levels, on-site construction. So somebody who's doing a level 2 bricklaying course this year, which will be in the workshop, laying bricks, it will have a theoretical element, but it will be a very small part of it. It will have some work experience in it. But instead, what they will be forced to do is to go onto a construction program at level 3 that is 80% classroom based. And from the kind of policy point of view, this is supposedly around creating parity with A-levels. And I think they just don't understand both the nature of vocational education and how that fits into workforce development. I mean, ultimately, I think this policy will fail because there won't be enough providers who will actually deliver this T-level construction because it's too difficult to do, but also it won't provide what employers need, and they won't have the skilled bricklayers to go on and build those 300,000 new homes and those new airports and those new roads. And equally, they won't be able to import the workers, which is the way that they've done it in the past because of the commitments that they have laid down for themselves around immigration. So this, it's just this level of fundamental disconnect and lack of understanding, which I think is probably reinforced now by just lack of interest this year.
Yeah, I think you're right, Alina, but I think the thing I'd add to that is that you're entirely correct. And also, higher education is clearly an instrument to achieve wider government objectives, right? And I think if you read the strategic grant letter and you think actually the problem we have in this country is low levels of productivity, growth isn't fast enough, what are the things you would do that? Surely the answer is expansion of education to get more people with more
skills. Yeah, the letter doesn't look like the answer to the questions, does it?
No, it doesn't. It looks like the question that's being asked is how do you have a system which is cheaper? Not the question which is how do you have a system which meets the skill needs of the future? And, you know, makes life worth living by having all of those good creative stuff, which yes, have an economic cost to them. But, you know, if our sort of ambitions for our country is to measure everything by the pound, then I think we are on for a pretty miserable existence.
Great. Now let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi there, I'm Andy Smith, and I'm the Quality and Standards Manager at the Quality Assurance Agency for Higher Education. This week on Wonky, my colleague Laura and I have been blogging about the subject benchmark statements to mark the publication of 13 revised statements. For the last 24 years, subject benchmark statements have provided standard reference points which are used by higher education providers in the design, development and delivery of courses across the UK. They're produced by academic experts in each subject area in collaboration with students and professional bodies. They act as a map to guide subject communities to their destination, whether that is revalidating existing courses or designing new ones. The subject specialists who create these statements put in massive efforts to represent the richness and diversity of their disciplines. And in our blog, we consider the continuing value and impact of this work and ask whether it's all still worth it. Spoiler alert, we absolutely think it is.
Now, next up this week, there's a new call for evidence on the Disabled Students Allowance. Selina, what's afoot here?
Well, the DfE has opened a call, a consultation for evidence about the Disabled Students Allowance, and in particular the non-medical help that is what the purpose of the DSA is there to fund. So the call is basically asking whether or not this current system, which is where the DSA is paid to individual students and the individual student will go and procure their own support, whether that should be changed and whether or not the higher education provider should be responsible for providing that support. It is a consultation, as I say, that explicitly asks for evidence to be submitted, which I think is interesting, because what they are sort of saying is the problem with the system as is a lot of kind of technical administrative issues. So a lack of integration of support in terms of the administration of the scheme. So they point to the fact that not all students currently access all of the support that's available. They also talk about a supply shortage in terms of the skilled non-medical helpers. That's quite a sort of lengthy, you might say rigorous set of qualifications and specifications that are needed for you. If you're a student that needs a specialist mentor, then there is a specific list that you need to get your helper from. And the other thing around it is also, from their perspective, the value for money, because this is a system that, as I say, relies on individual procurement. So it's sort of saying there's all these things that are wrong and we need to put these things right so that we can improve things for students. But I think that if you look at the way in which the consultation sort of poses what it calls the fundamental principles behind this, I think it is a bit more worrying, a bit more disconcerting in terms of what they're trying to set this up as is, well, at the moment, the DSA follows a medical model of disability. So the focus being on fixing the person's impairment for providing support for them as an individual, rather than the social model of disability, where it is about removing barriers. So that sounds very reasonable. I think that's kind of language language that we're all more familiar with now? And why shouldn't we be more progressive as a society and have, you know, a higher education system where all of those barriers are removed rather than lots of individuals trying to create, you know, means of getting beyond those barriers from their own individual perspective. But with a lot that's changed in sort of disability policy more generally over the last 20 odd years, the words sound great, the theory sounds great, but the everyday experience and practice of people who live with their disability and try to navigate their way through life, they're having to wait for those systems to catch up. And I think one of the things that we would worry about here is those students that go to a good, large, well-funded institution may find that those, you know, the system barriers have been removed, the institution has acted in concert, and they have a comparable or a better experience. But I think the reality for a lot of individual students will be, not because they don't want to, but their provider hasn't got the resources in this area, already under extreme pressure, to be able to provide the kind of support that they need on a institution-wide basis, which is what it would require. So I think lots of reasons to be concerned, plus, going back to our previous discussion, the wider sort of suspicion that there is no improved funding at the moment. Everything is a means to reducing the DfE's commitment.
Pete, let's just hang out in the weeds for a second, right? So obviously, just before it gets to the bit where it says, well, you know, universities and providers should be responsible for these things rather than there being a kind of state entitlement. It does this, as Selena says, comparison between the kind of social model and the medical model. And just to hang out in the weeds for a second. So if a student needs a BSL interpreter, I think what the call for evidence is saying is that universities really should have made sure that everything is being BSL interpreted, and that's reasonable, and that what that would do is remove the need for someone to go and book one. Now, you know, there are real interesting legal debates about adjustments and what's reasonable and so on, but regardless of whether it's reasonable or not, there's a cost, isn't there?
Absolutely. It's quite a high cost because it's a highly skilled role that takes many years to train for. And I think it's ironic that a government that failed to provide BSL interpretation for some of its key messages around the lockdown phases of the pandemic that we're still experiencing is suggesting that everyone should provide it as a matter of course. I'm not sure that they're entirely suggesting that. I think they're probably saying that you should take it into account and you might want to develop systems within your organisation for BSL interpretation, but good luck with that. When the courts can't find sufficient numbers, other education providers can't find sufficient numbers, the immigration system can't find sufficient numbers. So I think it's a fallacy. I don't believe that there is a genuine social model intent that is driving this. I think there's a financial reduction. And I'd be really interested to see what the equality impact assessment that prevented in other sectors that are important, like the travel sector, there was that proposal to shut down train ticket offices, the idea being to redeploy staff more effectively. I think the equality impact assessment that prevented that would probably have something to say about this and the massive impact it would have on disabled students, particularly the most impacted students. So deaf students, students with visual impairment, students only with autism, who require quite a reasonably high level of support, at least in the initial stages, to overcome the medical model challenges, the barriers that are faced by many students.
Hmm. James, in many ways, there's a sort of theme here, right? So, you know, government is saying that, you know, there are some problems here. It's a bit of, you know, it's a pain in the arse for individual disabled students to have to do all this kind of commissioning and manage the relationships, make it simple, put it all inside one place. But then, so, you know, there's a lever it wants to pull, there's an objective it wants to make, but it wants to put the funding for that objective inside students' tuition fees rather than an actual funding lever it can pull, which is state funding. And that drive for value for money, in theory, makes it harder to achieve the objective rather than easier, doesn't it? Or am I missing something?
Yes, but there's two things there, Jim. So, you know, I suppose a bit like the strategic grants letter discussion we were just having, you can't put every funding for everything ever in tuition fees. and just say, well, you already get some funding, go and do it. And you can't just keep repurposing the same funding for everything. The premise I start off on this is, what is the best thing for students? Because ultimately, you know, this is about student support. And I think there's two separate debates here. So logistically, does it make sense to have a single place and a single point of contact where a range of services are available that are easy to access on tap? Yes, providing they are specialist appropriate and they are of a quality which students need. And whether the resources available for that, I am not entirely convinced. But then the second question is that the most efficient way to resource that? And that has to come, I can't see how you can do that without a separate funding pot, because all else you are doing is saying, take on additional things with a dwindling unit of resource, and the result of that can't be a better service. That just won't happen.
Selina, I guess the other thing that concerns me, and I've put this in the blog, is that, you know, one of the things about having, if you're a student, a relationship with three or four bodies, is that when one of the bodies sort of doesn't work or gives you the runaround or fails or whatever, at least, you know, you're sort of, your eggs are spread, I guess, across multiple baskets. But, you know, it seems to me that, you know, whilst providers will say they haven't got a lot of money, and that is absolutely true, there are definitely some providers that have got the money to make reasonable adjustments and to deliver decent services and don't. And then getting those providers to deliver those adjustments is really hard work for an individual student. And I can't see how that problem is even identified, let alone addressed.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think probably if you've worked in any kind of sort of university pastoral role, whether it be in a student union or on university administration, quite a lot of your time will be spent trying to take up those kind of individual battles. And generally, it's not that you're fighting a specific resistance, it's you're fighting an oversight. And one of the things that you do talk about, actually, in your excellent blog, Jim, that you've written looking at this piece, is the fact that universities themselves don't necessarily have good sight of which students coming in with which needs until they arrive. I mean, even more so now, yes, you might apply in advance, but we all know that people aren't going to be committed until a few weeks before the course starts. So with the best will in the world, with all the resource and all the good intent, it's still quite complex for universities to set up a support package for individual students. Whereas I think if the resource sits with the individual student and you're thinking about going to university, actually, pragmatically, part of your choice may well rest on the kind of support that you're able to secure to support your learning at a particular place on a particular course. And you know your needs better than anybody. So I think there's a real potential. And you're right, it's not kind of even seen as a problem in this consultation. I suspect because, again, although it keeps mentioning this word evidence, I don't get the feel as I read through it that it is practitioners or it is students with disabilities that have highlighted the problems in this system. This feels like problems that have been identified from a bureaucratic point of view, not from an experience point of view.
And talking of bureaucracy, can we just point out that the universities are hamstrung on what provision the student's being given by the DSA, because they're not allowed sight of the letter unless the student permits it. And there are multiple other barriers involved in it from a bureaucratic process, not less that the student who's usually got a print impairment or a difficulty writing, having to fill in a multiple page form that then takes a long time to be processed by the student loan company. And it's great that they have KPIs that they mention in there, but what they do is they publish their KPI and whether they're meeting it or not. Not that it's being hit. The focus is on the bureaucratic process of hitting the KPI, not on the delay. So they may publish that it's 2-week delay, 3-week delay, 4-week delay. It may have improved over the last few years, but it's not improved nearly enough to stop the hamstringing process that universities have in a desire to put in place the support that is part funded by the DSA, but an inability to do so by the bureaucratic system within which we're all having to work.
More generally, Pete, I have got a question, right? And I don't know whether this is a legal question or a moral question or in some ways both, but it seems to me that when you've got a sort of central system that can support, quite significant, addressing barriers that students face. If you then put that on individual providers, and you know, we have got 400 odd providers in England, a really long tail of very small providers, right? Does it change the balance of reasonableness? Because, you know, what's reasonable for, you know, a large Russell Group university in a big city may not be reasonable for a tiny, you know, performing arts theatre company. Now, I've no doubt there's a slightly different answer whether you're answering legally or morally or practically, but it just feels to me that one of the things that the current system does, however bureaucratic it is it removes a little bit of the, well, the university or the provider is under pressure or small or busy or, do you know what I mean? That thing.
Well, the case law suggests that if you are a large provider with a big overall financial position that's positive, then that you should have no quibble at all with any reasonable adjustments as long as it doesn't exceed the budget that you've set aside for that. There's a foreign office, and it was a sign language interpreting case that derived that case law. So I would not be against the larger institutions being given a pot of money centrally to resolve this, because I think they'd have the capacity and the capability to do it. Then I think the smaller institutions should get additional support in a much more agile system that supports the students that they would be, having within their institutions on a more externally funded and externally resourced basis. So I don't think that there's a problem with this, the distinction between the two, because those institutions need that support. But the larger ones can probably develop systems and have had to, because the DSA system doesn't apply to international students. And so larger, more resourced institutions have had to set up parallel systems to the DSA system to provide support for those students and make those decisions as you're going along the lines of, Jim, where, you know, what is an excessive amount of money based on what we've put aside.
James, what's your read on the politics here? So, you know, we haven't got a minister has not signed this, you know, there's no name of a minister on this, kind of curiously. It's appearing, you know, within the middle of what must be a run-up to an election. There's no sense that the overall student maintenance system is due for a review. Where is, you know, what's going on?
So, I mean, I think let me take a charitable reading of this, is that there is clearly an identified problem with the availability of support. And let's assume that, you know, there is good intention in going out and asking for some evidence and what should this look like. Do I think the current system is sufficient? No. So therefore, do I think of thinking something different is good? Yes. Do I think that this type of exercise can reconcile some of the fundamental tensions of things like, how do we organise maintenance grants? What does institutional support look like? Do we organise services in or out of universities? No, because while they are questions about disabled students and their support, they are also questions about actually how do we choose to fund all of higher education? And also, what is the appropriate limit between institutional support and wider societal ones? So I feel like it is coming out of a reasonable intention, but the scope is potentially both too narrow to solve what is ultimately a societal question, and too broad in taking on some massive institutional questions in the guise of this consultation.
And then, Selena, just one final question on this. And, you know, I don't mean this to sound as controversial as it does, but one of the things that strikes me when I read it is, why is it that an individual student that enrolls at a university should be paying from their tuition fees rather than the tax they pay for really very expensive adjustments for disabled students? Is that legitimate to be doing this through the tuition fee debt rather than the state? You know, where should that balance be?
Well, my view would be, no, it's not. And I think, you know, one of the things that we're, from a student perspective, is, you know, an ever-growing call is transparency around where their tuition fees is spent, just at the level of the individual institution. Because I think, one of the frustrations of the current system is that it doesn't work for anybody. It doesn't provide universities with enough resource. It doesn't make students feel like they're getting value for money. It doesn't make staff feel like they are appropriately rewarded. It's one of those systems that literally has been kind of created by default that doesn't deliver on anybody's agenda. So in my view, it's a fundamental error to think that these are the kind of costs that should go through essentially what the tuition fee should cover. I think students, from a customer perspective, expect their individual tuition costs to be, you know, the lion's share of what their tuition fee pays for.
Well, fascinating stuff. Plenty more stuff on the site. Now, finally this week, the Nursing and Midwifery Council has raised the red flag over some of the courses it regulates. What is going on here, Pete?
So when you are Qualifying to be a nurse, you'd need to undertake a certain amount of practice hours, 2,300 in total, to be eligible to register as a nurse for the MNC. Some of those hours you can do through what's called simulation-based exercises, where you don't actually have to be in clinical practice. And that during the lockdown phases of the pandemic, that was required so that we could still keep nurses training. In fact, many of them probably could do their practice hours because they went in on the front line of the NHS, as we know. But subsequent to the lockdown phases being rescinded, the NMC reduced its guidance around what was allowed in terms of simulation versus what had to be in practical clinical settings. And they've gone and done some reviews of particular providers, not all providers, and found that there's been a level of misunderstanding in some institutions around what's simulation and what's not. And this includes, simulation, it sounds like, oh, are we talking about virtual reality and being able to...
Prodding dummies.
Yeah.
Someone described it to me yesterday.
Yeah. Well, and that's kind of one of the areas. But there's also practice-based reflection, which needs to be done with a qualified healthcare professional reflecting on your practice. There's some online and e-learning activity that could also represent simulation. And there's some good guidance from the Royal College of Nursing, the RCN, on what that looks like. But it looks like, in some instances, about 5.5 hours a week of what nurses in training considered to be eligible is not. So we've got a situation where a reasonable cohort of nurses in some institutions are having to find perhaps 200 to 300 hours that they thought they'd covered off and make up for them. So they won't be allowed to register after they graduate. There needs to be lots of organizational kind of discussions around how we're going to resolve this issue.
Yes. Now, Selina, it feels like a bit of a paradox in here because, you know, on the one hand, I think if I was one of those affected students, I would feel really, really aggrieved. You know, the potential loss of earnings. You know, it's not like if you're a nursing student, you can hold down a couple of part-time jobs like on some courses. You know, people will be really keen to get into the workforce. And frankly, as a citizen, I'm really keen that they are in the workforce so that they, you know, if I go to hospital, that they exist. But it also strikes me that this is a group of students who are the least likely to do that sort of make a complaint, get the appeal, go to the OIA, wait 18 months. Do you know what I mean? That thing. We seem to have a kind of disconnect between the injustice that some students will face here and then the process that we assume they will go through to resolve it.
Yes. I think it's fair to say that you would be very unhappy, and it feels to me like it's a failure at one level of the regulator, of the system that should hold the accountability system. Institutions, I wonder how aggrieved they feel in terms of the kind of understanding that they have had about what was expected and what was countable. But the other thing is, just sort of going back, if you like, to the sort of public or even quite scarily the patient perspective, this is part of our workforce that over the last 5 years, you could say various changes to the nursing training system has made it a less attractive deal, starting from the point at which the funding for nursing training changed, and the expectations around the hours that a student nurse would need to put in. So I think, you know, these are the people that we want to go into the workforce. We desperately need. There's all sorts of recruitment problems within the health service. And, you know, whatever the future government is, whatever, you know, there is going to be a increasing, ever increasing need for well qualified, well motivated nurses to enter the system. And you know, if it was me in this situation, you would feel really pissed off and not, you know, there's nothing you can really do about it. But I wonder where that kind of their voice will come through. And I suspect it doesn't come through sort of, you know, above the surface. It will come through in other ways later down the line. They will feel aggrieved, and people hold on to that when they start a career. So I don't think it's something that will dissipate and go away.
James, how do we, you know, how do we fix this kind of problem? Because it seems to me that although this is a fairly crunchy case, there are actually plenty of courses where there are quite legitimately some, you know, proper robust standards about what people must have done or learned or whatever. You know, and you know, when it goes wrong, that is really, really difficult for students. And it's often in professions where I guess students won't want to be making a fuss or putting their head above the parapet or challenging their institution because they're trying to get a career.
Yeah, I mean, the thing I don't know, Jim, is how big is this problem? So they've written to providers after inspecting a handful and noticing some themes. But how many students is this affecting across the piece, and therefore how many nurses have now qualified? And I think that's the place I'd be starting with, because obviously this is not only bad for students who, you know, potentially have been doing things that they haven't done the things that they should have been, but clearly this is bad for care. You know, my mother-in-law is a nurse, and reflective practice and ongoing training is an enormous part of her job. I think the other thing that I would just add to this is that I'm not sure how far we should try and draw extrapolations to other types of programs like this that have had emergency measures put in because of COVID, where there are professional requirements, because we simply don't know. Perhaps if there was some sort of regulator for higher education who could look into this type of thing rather than chasing around business schools, then there might be, you know, an opportunity to look at this, for example.
But there is an interesting read across here. So, you know, one of the issues in the student group claim case, which in theory is off to the High Court in May, is students in the kind of second half of the pandemic that were saying, look, I was promised an experience of X. I would get my hands dirty doing X. And although the university made some changes to the regs so that I could graduate with my award, what I didn't experience was getting my hands dirty doing X. And therefore, you know, there was a breach of contract and so on. This tension between, you know, the kind of overall learning outcomes and then what people are supposed to experience seems to me to be really important, both in this case and for lots and lots of students on lots of programs who are going to university partially to get experience in doing things.
Yep, and in healthcare is a perfect example of where you may not get what you thought it said on the tin. That there are still healthcare settings where COVID breakouts mean that you can't go in, or there are restrictions around that. That we talked about the capacity elements in terms of if you've got a workforce reduced in the hundreds of thousands from what it's meant to be, how are they going to find time for placement students? How are they going to find settings that are appropriate? And the cuts in the higher education sector as well mean that it's going to be ever more challenging. And I think one of the reasons that this group of students are probably not going to be able to get together to do a complaint is because they're all working. They're all actually out there having to earn the money to pay the fees for their accommodation, their additional travel costs, which are way, you know, to get to these placements, they've got to get there. They don't kind of beam in. They've got to make physical progress across regions, usually not from not locally. And my wife works frontline NHS. She's a nurse of many years' experience and now an advanced clinical practitioner. And it's not good out there. You know, believe the news on this. This isn't fake news. The healthcare system is crumbling. So trying to fit nursing placements into that crumbling sector, it's not a surprise that some inefficiencies have happened and some problems have happened. But there does seem to be as well a level of misunderstanding, and that might be at program level or that might be at institutional level. It did say in the coverage that they're not trying to remove the capacity to train students from any particular institution. So it doesn't look like there's been a kind of fundamental error. But I think the experience that nurses are having and have had probably for the last 5 to 10 years has not been probably what they'd hoped and expected.
I don't know the answer to it, Pete, but you know, on your point, somebody asked in the comments to Jim's article of how clear was the guidance if lots of institutions have made the same mistake? And I don't know the answer to that, but I think that'd be another interesting place to look responsibility.
I looked at some of the Royal College of Nursing particular guidance on this just ahead of coming on today, because I've got contacts within the RCN. And it's pretty comprehensive and it's pretty clear, but you know, have you had time to read and adapt to it, because you would have been managing the kind of lockdown phase of this, and then you've got to implement it. And that's not kind of within a nice period of an academic year. It's within that kind of ongoing rolling program that nursing training is. So, Absolutely. And I take your point, because one of the areas we talked about e-learning and online learning as being not quite simulation based and shouldn't really be counted towards. And I suppose it's, what do you mean by that? Could you do your reflective practice in a Zoom setting? Is that online? You know, if you're supervised by a clinically qualified professional. So that I think there probably is ambiguity in some of that.
James, should they get, let's say they're delayed into the workforce by 6 weeks. Should they get 6 weeks salary?
I mean, so in theory, if you lose out on earnings due to something that isn't your fault, yes, you should be compensated by that. I think the problem is you would have to determine, would they have absolutely been employed anyway? Who's at fault for making that error? The numbers of students who've been affected, and how much could they have reasonably expected to earn? So I think if there is a look at this, and actually it turns out that students' consumer rights have been broke, albeit I know it's different for nursing, then yeah, of course they shouldn't be treated differently from the rest of the population.
I'm never sure I ever understand the question that's been asked, Jim. I think you're right. I think you can design a system of kind of recompense, but if it is too complex for you to navigate your way through, then it's meaningless, isn't it? And I think in a lot of cases, with all sorts of student-oriented complaints within higher education, it is just too complex. And probably as well, as we kind of indicated with this one, at a point in time in your life where you had just got more pressing priorities. I mean, even if you did it as a kind of cost benefit analysis, do I invest my time, trying to press this complaint, or do I just get on now into the workforce and concentrate with getting through the first year of my job, which for any new professional is a very stressful time. A lot of the learning is going to actually happen in that first year. So do I want to be distracted by this? Can I afford to be? I don't want to imperil in any way the first early sort of months of my new job.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to dig a bit deeper into anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can get the latest show automatically when it's out. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And to find out how we can keep you and where you work ahead of everything going on in UKHE, do head to the site and click subscription. So thanks very much to Pete, Selena, James, Michael Salmon, who makes the show happen. We'll be back next week. Mark will be here. Until then, stay wonky.